Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Phil Dierking and Alice Bryant. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, the Pacific nation of Vanuatu is preparing to permanently evacuate the entire population of one of its islands. Thick ash from a volcano kills crops, dirties water, and pollutes the air for the 10,000 people who live on Ombai Island. Some are eager to leave, but others are resisting losing their land and culture. Most people on Ombai live by farming and fishing. Hundreds of people have already created temporary homes on parts of the island that are not so affected by the ash. Ombai is one of about 65 inhabited islands in Vanuatu, an island country of 280,000 people. The country is on the Pacific Ocean's Ring of Fire, an area where earthquakes and volcanoes are common. The people who lived on Ombai Island were temporarily evacuated last September when the volcano erupted. This time, authorities are planning a permanent move. Countries including France, New Zealand, and Australia provided aid and financial help for the earlier evacuation. On Thursday, Australia announced it was providing $300,000 to help with the island's permanent evacuation. Government spokesman Hilaire Buell told the Associated Press that he expects the move to be approved by next week. He said officials still had to organize many details, including providing schools for students and homes for people. Buell said the population will be offered places on two neighboring islands, Maiwo and Pentecost. Many people from Ombai have close family and spiritual ties to the two islands. Traditional religion says that the three islands are part of a family: Pentecost, the mother; Maiwo, the father; and Ombai, the son. When asked if the islanders might be able to move back someday, Buell said that was not a question for him. He added, "You'll have to ask the volcano."
NASA, the American Space Agency, is sending a robotic scientist to Mars. It will dig deeper than ever before to study the planet's geological activity. The Mars InSight spacecraft launches May 5th. On Mars, the spacecraft will use scientific instruments to take the first measurements of Mars quakes, or quakes on Mars. It will also measure the circular movement of Mars on its axis to better understand the size and makeup of its core. The spacecraft's instruments will permit scientists to stare down deep into the planet, said Bruce Bannert. He is with NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the mission's chief scientist. The $1 billion joint U.S.-European mission marks the first study of the inside of Mars. Scientists hope the research will help them understand how Mars formed 4.5 billion years ago. Mars is smaller and less geologically active than Earth. On Earth, geological movements over time have changed the planet's original makeup. Mars, though, has more evidence of its early development, Bannert said. During the launch, InSight will also take two small satellites with it. After liftoff, the satellites will break free and then follow the spacecraft for 6 months as it travels to Mars. The satellites will not stop at Mars, though. Instead, they will fly past the planet. Scientists call the two satellites CubeSats. Their purpose is to test whether they can provide a communication link with InSight as it lands on Mars on November 26th. InSight will launch from Central California's Vandenberg Air Force Base. It will be the first time that NASA has launched a mission to another planet from somewhere other than Florida's Cape Canaveral. The trip to Mars will be difficult. Only 40% of spacecraft that have tried to reach the red planet have made it. The United States is the only country to have successfully landed and operated spacecraft on Mars. The first time was in 1976, with the Viking 1 and 2 spacecraft. The most recent landing was in 2012 by the Curiosity rover. A rover is a space exploration vehicle designed to move across the surface of a planet. The InSight will use a parachute and engine firings to lower itself to Mars. Scientists predict it will take 7 minutes for the spacecraft to enter the atmosphere of Mars and then land on the planet. However, Bannert says landing on Mars with a spacecraft that is not much bigger than two office desks will not be easy. Once on the surface, InSight will dig almost 5 meters into the planet's surface. At the same time, a robotic arm will place a scientific instrument that measures quakes on Mars's surface. It will detect the planet's vibrations. InSight stands for Interior Exploration Using Seismic Investigations, Geodesy, and Heat Transport. It weighs 694 kilograms. It has 3 legs and will not be able to move around. InSight's scientific mission is similar to NASA's Apollo program in the late 1960s and early 1970s. At that time, Apollo astronauts dug over 2 meters into the moon's surface so that scientists back home could measure the moon's underground flow of heat. Earlier Mars missions have dug just below the surface to research the red planet's rocks, minerals, atmosphere, and magnetic fields. But Bannert says scientists have never examined any deeper into the surface. Mars is still a pretty mysterious planet, Bannert said. Even with all the studying that we've done, it could throw us a curveball. I'm Phil Dierking.
Imagine we are having a conversation about dance. Suddenly, I say, because I love to dance. You might learn something about me, that I love dancing, But you might also look at me strangely, since I told you only a reason for something, but I didn't tell you anything else about it. If my remark does not seem like a complete sentence, that is because it is not. The words, because I love to dance, are something called a clause, a group of words that contain a subject and a verb. You might remember the definition of a clause from a past everyday grammar program. Today, we will show you the difference between dependent and independent clauses. In the example about dance, the subject is I and the verb is love. But because I love to dance does not express a complete thought. It is a dependent clause. English has three common types of dependent clauses: noun clauses, relative clauses, and adverb clauses. It would be unusual to write a paragraph or talk for a few minutes without using at least one of these. In fact, in my first few paragraphs alone, I have used at least two of these types of clauses. Ultimately, understanding how clauses work will help you identify and avoid incomplete or structurally unsound sentences. And this will strengthen your speaking skills and especially your writing skills. As I just said, a clause is a group of words with a subject and a verb. But that structure alone does not guarantee a complete sentence. Clauses can be dependent, or incomplete, or independent, or complete. Every complete sentence in English contains at least one clause. Many sentences have two or more clauses. So let's return to our example about dance. If I said to you, "I never miss Samantha's class because I love to dance," I would be expressing myself in a complete sentence. The sentence has two clauses, "I never miss Samantha's class," and "because I love to dance." Independent clauses contain the main subject and main verb of a sentence. They express clear thoughts and can stand alone as sentences. In our example, "I never miss Samantha's class" is an independent clause. It is a complete sentence on its own and does not need "because I love to dance" to express a complete thought. In sentences containing more than one clause, independent clauses are usually called main clauses. Now let's talk about dependent clauses, also called subordinate clauses. Remember, the clause "because I love to dance" contains a subject and verb, but it is still dependent. It leaves you feeling like something is missing. Another good indication that this clause is dependent is that the word "because" signals an adverb clause, but it only contains one subject and one verb. So the other part of the sentence, the independent clause, is missing. Dependent clauses depend on or need independent clauses to express complete thoughts. Listen to more examples of dependent clauses and decide for yourself. Does it seem like something is missing? Listen.
If my aunt arrives by 3 p.m.
That's an adverb clause.
Who lives in the building?
That's a relative clause.
What you did last summer?
That's a noun clause. Again, all of these are dependent clauses. They leave you knowing that you need more information to get the complete idea. Words like "if," "because," "who," "what," "that," and other words often but not always signal dependent clauses. Now let's listen to complete sentences for each example.
We can still see the monuments today if my aunt arrives by 3 p.m. My friend, who lives in the building, is away this weekend. I know what you did last summer.
You may recognize this third sentence as the title of a 1997 American horror film adapted from a book of the same title. Each of the examples contains two clauses, a dependent clause connected to an independent clause. Remember, independent clauses express complete thoughts by themselves. So, we can still see the monuments today. My friend is away this weekend, and even I know are all independent clauses. They are complete sentences on their own. However, their dependent clauses provide more information. Being able to recognize independent and dependent clauses lays the foundation for understanding the three main types of clauses: noun clauses, adverb clauses, and relative clauses. And this is a skill that will go a very long way in helping you make progress on your English speaking and writing. Join us again soon when we will tell you about adverb clauses. I'm Alice Bryant.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Morris Joyce and Frank Oliver continue the story of the man who served as America's 22nd and 24th president, Grover Cleveland.
Grover Cleveland began his second presidency in 1893. His two terms were separated by the presidency of Benjamin Harrison. Cleveland took office again just as the United States was entering an economic depression. Businesses failed. Banks closed their doors. Workers lost their jobs. And farmers lost their farms. President Cleveland believed the depression was caused by the government's money policy. At that time, both gold and silver were used to support the value of the American dollar. In Europe, however, only gold was used. American investors and bankers were afraid their money would drop in value because of the use of silver. They began exchanging their money for gold. President Cleveland wanted to return to the gold standard, too. To do this, he had to urge Congress to kill a law which forced the government to buy silver. Before Congress began its debate, the president discovered a cancer in his mouth. The cancer needed to be removed immediately, but the operation had to be kept secret. News that the president's life was in danger could have an effect on the debate. It could make the nation's economic crisis worse.
So, the operation was done on a private boat in New York Harbor. Doctors removed some of President Cleveland's teeth and much of his upper left jaw. Then they removed the cancer. The operation took only a half hour. After a few weeks, doctors made Cleveland a new jaw out of hard rubber. He wore it without difficulty. A newspaper printed a story about the operation, but administration officials denied it. The facts did not become public for many years.
When President Cleveland returned to Washington, he sent a message to members of Congress. He urged them to kill the law which forced the government to buy silver. He noted how people throughout the nation had been exchanging their paper money and silver for gold. He said he was afraid the Federal Treasury would soon run out of gold. Then it would have only silver to support the dollar. If that happened, he said, the United States no longer could claim to be a major nation. President Cleveland said, "The people of the United States have a right to a money recognized as such on every exchange and in every market of the world. Their government has no right to injure them by financial experiments that are opposed to the policies of other nations."
After the president's message was read, the House of Representatives began its debate. A young congressman from Nebraska spoke in opposition to the president's position. His part in the debate made him famous throughout the nation. His name was William Jennings Bryan. Bryan said the United States should continue to make and use both gold and silver money. Using only gold, he said, increased the value of the dollar, and that made life difficult for America's farmers and workers. They had to pay more to borrow money, and for farmers, a more valuable dollar meant lower prices for crops. Bryan described the situation this way. On one side of the debate stand the business interests of the United States. On the other side stand the unnumbered masses. Work-worn and covered with dust, they make their appeal. But too often, their cry for help has sounded hopelessly against the outer walls, while others, less deserving, find easy entrance to the halls of Congress. The president is wrong to act on the demand of the business interests. He can no more judge the wishes of the great mass of our people by the words of these middlemen than he can measure the ocean's silent depths by the foam upon its waves.
No other congressman spoke as well as William Jennings Bryan. Yet his words could not save the silver purchase law. The House of Representatives approved President Cleveland's proposal to kill the law. The Senate did too. The United States was firmly on the gold standard. Everyone, especially President Cleveland, waited for the economy to improve. It did not.
More businesses failed. More workers lost their jobs. Tens of thousands of men left their homes to look for work. Some of these men began to unite in protest groups they called industrial armies. One industrial army was organized by a man named Jacob Coxey. Coxey proposed that the federal government should hire unemployed men to build roads. He said the government could borrow enough money to pay each man $1.50 a day. Coxey decided to take his proposal to Washington. He also decided to take his industrial army with him.
Coxey's army marched many kilometers from Ohio to Washington. Hundreds of unemployed men joined in along the way. But by the time the army reached the Capitol, only 300 men remained. City officials barred Coxey's army from meeting on public property. They barred them from asking people for food or money. Jacob Coxey was ready for the worst. He said, "If my men starve in the streets of Washington, The smell of their bodies will force Congress to act. Coxey tried to read a protest statement at the Capitol building. Police stopped him. The protesters then pushed forward in what police later called a riot. Several of the men, including Coxey, were arrested. A judge found Coxey guilty of violating public property. He sent him to jail for 20 days. Without Coxey's leadership, his army broke up. Its members went home. Yet, the economic and social pressures which created Coxey's army did not ease. Protests and strikes continued throughout the nation.
The biggest strike started in Chicago against the Pullman Company, which made railroad cars. The man who owned the company, George Pullman, also owned the town where his workers lived. He owned the stores, the houses, the schools, and the library. When the economic depression began in 1893, George Pullman cut the size of his workforce. Those still working received less pay. Yet, Pullman did not reduce the cost of rent for his houses. Anyone who protested lost his job.
In the spring of 1894, a labor union organizer went to George Pullman's town. He was Eugene Debs, leader of the American Railway Union. Pullman did not want his workers to belong to a union, but he did not stop them at first. More than 4,000 workers joined. Immediately, the new union members voted to go on strike against the Pullman Company. Other members of the union supported them. They agreed not to work on trains that included Pullman cars. Within a few days, 60,000 railway workers were on strike. 20 railroads were closed down. Union leader Eugene Debs attempted to keep the strike peaceful, but he could not control strikers all over the country. So, railroad companies asked the federal government for troops to break the strike.
The request involved a legal point. America's Constitution says federal troops cannot be sent to a state unless the state government asks for them. And no state government had asked for them. President Cleveland met with his cabinet to discuss the railroad company's request. They finally agreed to send federal troops to Chicago, where the strike had started, to enforce federal postal laws. The troops would protect trains carrying mail. The arrival of the troops led to more violence. Eugene Debs and other leaders of the American Railway Union were arrested. The Pullman strike ended.
President Cleveland faced increasing political problems. Organized labor denounced him for using federal troops to break up the Pullman strike. Farmers and Westerners attacked him for opposing the use of silver money. And everyone blamed him for not doing more to end the Depression. These political problems would have a great effect on the next presidential election.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.